are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, August 23rd, 2016. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it is one of those famous weeks where we go on vacation, yet you don't have to take a vacation from the show. How do we do that? Well, how is that possible? That can't possibly be. I must be having some type of episode. No. We have figured out some special technology where we record our voices and images on recording devices so that you may listen to it after the fact. Yes, it's true. Many of you listen to the show live, but many more of you listen to the show on recording. So in some respects, I didn't even have to tell you this. But that's the kind of guy I am, trying to be honest with you, looking you in the eyes, and I'm saying, we're on vacation, but yet, you get a new show, and it's a great one. A lot of people like these shows even better than the ones we do live, because there's a slightly different quality to the interview. I don't know what it is. There's a slightly different quality to it. Today on the program, Chris Lehman. He's the editor-in-chief of The Baffler? I don't know. He corrected me on the intro. But from The Baffler magazine, he is the author of The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. It is a fascinating look into the development of U.S. religion and capitalism, I guess. And it's fascinating. I really enjoyed this conversation. I think you're going to enjoy it as well. And the book is, it's a serious read. It's a good read. But it is, I have a lot of blind spots when it comes to different types of Christianity, because I'm so Jewy in my disposition. But this was a really good read, a great talk. And for members, of course, you'll get a Matt's pick. Just don't even tell me what the pick is. Just tell me what you're feeling emotionally to give me a sense of what the pick would be.
Well, it might be something from the Nixon tapes, too. I might include some of that stuff in here.
Okay, well, but that's not what I asked you. And now you're getting too specific. I want to know emotionally what your mood is so that it sets the predicate for why you picked what you picked.
Oh, gosh.
It could be anything. It may be from the show. It may be from the deep archive. It could, for all I know, it could be like, here's Matt sitting at the kitchen table with his mom.
Yeah, it's hard to predict my moods that far out in advance, Sam.
Well, I'm asking you to predict. All right, forget it. Let me tell you this, though. The one thing that I can predict, I can't predict Matt's mood. I can't even demand that he predict his own mood. But I can predict that even this week, well, we're on vacation this week, but when we get back, I'm going to have two exceptional meals when I get back over the week. I had two exceptional meals the week before I went on vacation. How do I know this? Why do I say this? Because, and I've mentioned this before, John Benjamin turned me on to this. He gave me a gift. I don't know why he did that, because he really has given me nothing. Good friend of mine, but, you know, aside from just sort of presence, not presence as with a T, but like being there, generally not terribly generous. But he gifted us Blue Apron, and it has changed the way that we eat, my family. As you know, I have a wife, a daughter, and a son. Son's 3, so it's really like 3.5 people eating. And Blue Apron delivers us two, not meals, two sets of ingredients to create delicious meals every week. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers across the United States. The seafood is sourced sustainably. The beef is raised humanely. They practice regenerative farming practices that from where they get their produce. And it can be delivered to 99% of the continental U.S. and 99.5% of food deserts. And because Blue Apron ships the exact amount that you need for a meal, and I have to say, like, spot on. Like, if you just have one or two spoonfuls that just push me over the edge where I say, like, I've eaten too much, which is exactly like where I like to get to. There's no waste. Now, maybe you've heard the statistic that cooking together builds strong family bonds. My daughter really enjoys cooking. I don't know. I can't really attest to our family bonds. I mean, it seems like we're just like all ships passing in the night in my house. But
at least you're aware of it.
Well, at least I'm aware of it. But the fact is that we cook together and we eat together. And if you eat out for us, I've never been able to really get through a meal, the cheapest, for $40. I don't even know if we've ever even hit that for the four of us. Okay? For dinner. You can spend under $10 a person with Blue Apron. And the meals are delicious. Last week, I had bibimbap made at home.
That's what I call Matt.
Bibimbap with salmon. It was delicious. And Saul ate fish.
Wow.
Yeah. No, it's fantastic. It was, I think it's sockeye salmon. Bibimbap. It was delicious. I've never had it before. And it's great. For less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers it to your house. They have Japanese ramen noodles, they have heirloom tomatoes, spiced pork burgers with goat cheese, cucumber corn salad, chicken tinga tacos with summer squash and tomato salsa. And check this out. If you go and check out this week's menu, you will get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/majority. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredibly good home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't stop. Don't wait. It's blueapron.com/majority. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. All right, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll be talking to Chris Lehman about the money cult. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. Chris Lehman, he is the senior editor and columnist for The Baffler and co-editor of Book Forum and author of his just released The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. Welcome to the program, Chris.
Thank you very much, Sam. I also just want to quickly, my bio has changed since the book came out. I'm now editor-in-chief of The Baffler and no longer affiliated with Book Forum.
Well, congratulations. I'm glad.
Well,
up
thank
and
you.
Up and onward. All right, so let me ask you, the thing that I find fascinating about this is that in many respects, maybe, I guess, the last three, but certainly the last two of the Republican nominees have played into sort of this archetype. And one wouldn't imagine that Donald Trump and Mitt Romney share much,
right.
I guess, except for...
they don't have a lot in common otherwise. Yep, it's true.
But, and I want to circle back to that. Before we
sure.
get to that, I mean, that's what I think is so fascinating about the work you've done here. But why... What made you look into this notion of really how, well, I guess we should start with the central premise that capitalism and a particular brand of Christianity that is particularly American, I guess is the best way to say
yeah.
it. Capitalism hasn't necessarily corrupted it. It's almost as if they are, they have, I don't know. It's like they've been genetically modified in some
yeah.
way and have been combined.
Yes. Now, and as a result, you have a both a kind of spiritualized vision of how capitalist success works, and a very money-driven vision of how Protestant, religious observance works. And it is, what drew me to it is kind of, I think any book comes in response to a question the writer is trying to answer for him or herself. And for me, I think like a lot of people, I had encountered this notion of, there's the famous essay by Max Weber in 1909 called The Protestant Ethic in the Spirit of Capitalism, which does a lot of great work explaining the origins of the kind of Puritan sensibility in the foundation of capitalism in both England and the United States. But the story kind of leaves off in the 18th century. Ben Franklin is sort of the philosopher hero of Weber's essay. And a lot has happened, I think, in both the religious sphere and the economic sphere since Benjamin Franklin sort of hymned the Protestant work ethic. And I was drawn by the idea, that we've gone from, Weber was describing what you might call the accumulative phase of capitalist development, where land and labor and production are all sort of amassing, heavenward, let's say. And we live in a very different world, one that's, very much driven by a disaccumulation of goods and services or a consumer society, to put it more broadly. And I wanted to see how the Protestant ethic has shifted in response to these developments and conversely, how, the economic common sense of American life has been shaped by these very, in my view, very significant and somewhat overlooked thought leaders, let's call them.
Yeah, I mean, you go through everybody. I mean, I had Norman Vincent Peale and all the way up to...
Who is, by the way, Donald Trump's favorite religious thinker.
I didn't know that. Before we get to that stuff, I want to start, though, at the origins, because I think, broadly speaking, there is not... I mean, what happened at the beginning in terms of, and what was it that was unique about... I mean, I guess it was unique to America's founding, at least in terms of like the Puritans.
The Puritans, were a dissident wing of the Anglican Church and rejected, the institution of the Anglican Church in large part in favor of a, more austere kind of religious observance. And part of this observance is, intense self-denial, but that also your anxiety about whether you're going to be, this whole idea of predestination, whether God has chosen you to be one of the, 111,000 or so souls who are guaranteed to be saved. And there's no way of knowing. The God of Puritanism is very, imperious and aloof and, can do whatever he wants, whenever he wants. So that's a little, that makes a true believer nervous, thinking every day to day that God can just kind of reach down and damn you for no reason at all. So the way Puritans kind of resolved all this inward tension was through the pursuit of a divinely sanctioned vocation. The one thing you could control as a Puritan believer was, your divine calling in the world. And that's what you concentrated on. That sensibility is what makes the Puritan work ethic so intense and so, powerful, because people are just trying to keep themselves busy while not thinking about being eternally damned.
and let me just add, because I mean, to a sure. certain extent, that dynamic, right, is how I think many people would describe the advent of religion, period, right? It's like some form of you know, you've got to give some type of incentive structure here so that you can maintain type of social control, right? Because you can't have everybody walking around thinking it's all just a lottery, because then they're, you know,
hierarchy is break down.
Exactly. And so was that adaptation or mutation a function of showing up in, you know, in Massachusetts and being like, oh, this is not going to be as easy as we thought?
Well, that certainly accelerated everything. And the original Massachusetts colonists also had to, you know, basically give 20% of one-fifth of all their wealth to the crown. So that's is itself a very powerful real-world incentive to, you know, be really productive and amass wealth. But I think, you know, the key thing about Puritanism for me, as the rest of the story unfolds, is it is intensely anti-institutional. One of the themes of the Puritans and throughout American religious history, you see this quest for the pure primitive church, you know, the church that doesn't have all the, you know, kind of corruption of the, you know, Roman Catholics, doesn't have the kind of, you know, perversion to all human institutions that, you know, are founded under the condition of original sin. What you want to get is to the core of, you know, what's called the primitive church, the church that's described in the book of Acts in the New Testament. And what's fascinating to me is that, you know, the book of Acts basically describes a primitive church that practices primitive socialism. All, you know, it's very clear that the early Christians held all property in common. You know, women were initially given positions of spiritual authority. These were pretty radical, you know, characters. And so there's this immediate paradox, right? If you're in America and you're trying to conquer this new world, you sure as hell aren't gonna, so to speak, you're not gonna practice a spiritualized socialism. So that part of the New Testament story always gets kind of shouldered aside. But
why not?
Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good question. And many of the, you know, radical dissenters back in England were, you know, very anarchist or syndicalist, you know, had very collectivist notions. I think why not is, you know, first of all, this was a highly educated elite. John Winthrop, the guy who delivered the famous sermon on the Arabella, was a very successful crown attorney in England. And the people who came over with him, you know, had I forget the exact percentage, but an absurdly high, you know, level of education for the time. So there was this self-selected, what we would today call assorted of mating. Mm-hmm. These were, you know, high achieving, you know, and the whole, you know,
we're the winners. Why would we give it away at this point?
Right. And also don't forget, God smiles on you via your vocation. So the more you accumulate, even though it's not, you know, it's also very clearly preached that you can't, you know, accept riches as a substitute for salvation, faith over works and all that. But at the same time, your vocation is, you know, how you establish your religious identity in the world. And it's inevitably bound up with your sense of spiritual self-worth. And you get this kind of, inadvertent accumulation of wealth. And it's a very quick transformation from that to the idea of the New World colonies as a new kind of promised land, that God is in fact rewarding his favored people with riches. And that's when the money cult sort of shifts into high gear, in my view.
It's funny because the I've had extended conversations with libertarians. One particular professor, when we got down to like sort of like what established, how do you establish property rights in this country, I think he had said basically, well, we're going to go by the French agrarian model, which is a rather sort of arbitrary decision to make at that point, except for the fact that it favored the people who came over, and it favored a certain, and that's,
which
it
is,
sounds,
you know,
like,
is, that is how history generally tends to work. You know, it is written by winners, but it is also, I think, you know, the point is the Protestant ethic got results. You know, they were able to, you know, conquer what to them was a alien wilderness, and and create all these settlements, and you know, so there's a very early, even before the American Revolution, which is very fascinating too, the, you know, the First Great Awakening, which is, you know, about 30 years before the revolution proper starts, galvanizes this proto-nationalist sentiment where, you know, very famous preachers like Jonathan Edwards are hailing, you know, what were then British military victories in Canada as a sign that, you know, God has, you know, won the day for his chosen people in the New World. And we are, you know, bringing the millennium to pass, which is another huge shift. Most of these radical dissenting groups in England were, this is all sort of arcane theology, so forgive me, but if you're a so-called premillennialist believer in prophetic Christianity, you believe that social reform is not productive. You know, God's going to come out of the sky and sweep everything away, and there's not going to be a thousand-year reign of Christ before the end times. That is technically what the millennium means. If you're a post-millennialist, you have this much more, you know, worldly and, you know, it's the brand of Protestantism that is most congenial to social improvement and material improvement. And American Protestants figure that out very quickly. And so you have this strange pivot where, you know, what had been, you know, premillennial, you know, doom and gloom prophecy believers from England become very sunny and optimistic about, yes, look, God is going to bring the millennium to pass here in America or the colonies, and we are instruments of his will.
And we can bring it about, right? I mean, that's the idea.
Through our work, again, through our work, yes.
So it's that same dynamic of saying, like, look, there's, you're not just, you know, this is not a lottery. Again, like, your work is actually going to aggregate and accrue and on some balance sheet somewhere. And
God rewards you.
And then God's going to give you this big balloon payment, I guess, at the end of it.
Yes. Yes, it's true, and you know, this strain of faith is also very interesting in that it's, you know, what I call Gnostic, which is another theological can of worms, but it's basically the idea that you can improve yourself as opposed to the more fatalistic, you know, what the Puritans originally believed in original sin and infant damnation and all that, where you don't have any practical control over what's going to happen to you in the afterlife. In the money cult, you know, there's this constant pressure to, you know, figure out ways, you know, that can't be true. I'm making money. I'm getting ahead. Everything is trending in this, you know, materially successful way. So the afterlife has to fall into line with that. And that's where you get, you know, in my view, Mormonism is an extreme expression of that sensibility, because Joseph Smith, who, you know, it's in many ways a theological genius, the most, you know, authentically homegrown American Protestant prophet, you know, preached a gospel where in the afterlife, Mormons not only get to inhabit their own planets and all the things you sort of hear about in pop culture, but they continue to work,
right.
Which is, that to me is such a pure American notion, that you get to the afterlife and you also continue to reproduce. You know, it's just sort of, you know, American prosperity turned up to 11.
And in fact, when Joseph Smith sees the angel at the foot of his bed, the angel's revealing this scripture essentially written in gold or written on gold.
Yes, and the gold stuff. You know, Joseph Smith was a money seeker, which was a weird vocation. And
literally, we should say. Right.
Yes. Yes, he would, he had what he called a peepstone that would allegedly permit him to see buried treasure in the ground in upstate New York and Vermont and the places where he was growing up.
It's like watching those metal detector guys on the beach.
Yeah, no, it's still very much with us. And the worship of gold is a spiritual, you know, that goes back to alchemy and all these kind of underground traditions of Western spirituality, which, you know, do figure very largely in the Mormon case, especially.
I mean, it certainly, I hadn't really thought about it in those terms, but it certainly explains, like, how unabashedly, I had always sort of interpreted, like, well, there has to be some measure of, I don't know, uncomfortability or embarrassment in Mitt Romney's wealth relative to the, and I had it absolutely backwards. It is
in many ways. I mean, Mormonism is also a really fascinating story because it too begins as an outsider faith of the economically dispossessed. These were, you know, like Joseph Smith's family, these were generations of kind of hardscrabble farmers who were barely getting by. And, you know, early Mormons also held property in common. And toward the end of his life, Brigham Young tried to revive a kind of socialist utopian version of Mormonism, but by then it was too late. And that's the other interesting thing of, you know, Pentecostalism almost follows the identical trajectory, you know, a century or so later. So you get all these churches that are, you know, or these denominations that are determined to uncover the primitive church and to, you know, discover the one pure way that they know God wants them to worship. And they wind up in this, you know, in the Mitt Romney position.
What accounts for those moments or eras where there is this pushback to make it, what accounts for that?
I think, you know, there are these other resources within, you know, and it shouldn't be forgotten that, you know, the Reform tradition in American Protestantism is really powerful. That, you know, the 19th century Protestant reformers, you know, brought us abolitionism and the fight for women's suffrage, going up to the 1960s, you know, you don't have the civil rights movement without the Black Church. So there is this countervailing tradition in American Protestantism that I think asserts itself when the sort of conventional structures of both political and economic well-being are working so well, right? the early 19th century, which is called the market revolution by historians, was a time of great, you know, upsurge and tremendous development of the American interior. But also, you know, the country was wrestling with the problem of slavery and people were trying to figure out ways to harness a scheme of salvation to movements for social reform. So you have both of these currents within American Protestantism. I just think over time, you know, another reason I wrote the book too is you see these kind of figures like Norman Vincent Peale or Joseph Smith or Russell Conwell, the guy who preached the Acres of Diamonds sermon in the early 20th or late 19th century. Treated it in isolation as though they're outliers and aberrant figures. And the fact is they continue to you know, build on each other's work in ways that we haven't looked at, because we generally tell the story of American religion as a story of denominational and theological dispute, which is, you know, part of it, certainly. But I think also just by nature of how the country has evolved and how its religious sensibility has evolved, it's also a story about capitalism and how you make the idea of individual, you know, abundance and prosperity palatable to a primitivist Christian sensibility that should on paper reject it.
I want to talk about what we see, you know, how this sort of translates into politics in a minute, but relative to Great Britain, I mean, what were there's a certain logic that on some level that of course the doctrine that encourages people to make money is going to have a leg up in society, because at the very least it's going to be well funded, right?
Yes.
Sort of like the brilliance of like Scientology, right? Like if I'm going to start a religion, it really should have a very important financial component to it, because that's going to help down the road in terms of its durability. But on some level, this is uniquely American, and to a certain extent, I know that we've begun to export it to some degree,
yes,
particularly to third world, to the third world, as it were. But why here? Just because we had a more or less type of year zero where it just so happened like it was populated by several score of wealthy people?
In part, but I think, you know, I've always maintained to secular progressive friends, of which I have many, that you don't understand much about America or our history if you don't understand this is a deeply religious country, and continues to be, always will be. And what's interesting, you know, when you talk about England or virtually any other European country, they've followed the traditional, you know, sociologists have this modernization thesis where as education levels rise in the general population of a society and, you know, science becomes a sort of de facto ruling ideology, people fall away from religious beliefs. They become secularized. They, you know, are indifferent churchgoers at best. That is almost has never happened in the United States. The United States is the great outlier for this thesis. I mean, you have lots of weird religious movements, and, you know, now there's a lot of talk about nuns, people who are not affiliated with the formal church but consider themselves spiritual. But the fact of the matter is the vast majority of our population has a very powerful, enduring belief in a supernatural God.
But is that, I mean, you know, and I guess I want to sort of pivot a little bit to
sure,
this election, because one of the things, as I've spoken to people about Donald Trump's evangelical support, is that one of the things that has come out in the polling is that there are evangelicals and then there are evangelicals. You know, like for mm-hmm. some, it's just, this is how I define myself. You know, I'm a Patriots fan.
Right.
But I, you know, I haven't had a chance to catch many games this year.
Right.
But I still consider myself a Patriots fan, even if I haven't been able to go to see one game, you know, this year, because whatever. When you say like we're still a deeply religious country, or that we are not following the paradigm, two mm-hmm. things strike me. One is is the price to refer to ourselves as being religious been lowered enough so that you don't really, you know, it's not a high commitment that you have to make to consider yourself religious?
Sure. Yeah.
And then the other question I have is, are we just simply too young as a country?
Oh, that's interesting. I think you know, to answer the second question first, I don't think we're, you know, we're not that young anymore. We're, what, 240? And, you know, we had a long colonial past prior to the formal, you know, founding. So I think, you know, I feel pretty confident given, you know, 400 plus years of Protestant history deeply bound up with the outlook of capitalist success that this is a key plank of our, what you might call our informal civic religion, that, you know, people, it's very hard when you look out upon the Protestant landscape today, you know, and think about it, this is 8 years after, you know, the most calamitous economic downturn since the Great Depression. There's been no hard times kind of version of, you know, prophecy. In fact, it's been the opposite. In fact, Joel Osteen, who is the other sort of signal figure, I think, in explaining Trump's appeal to evangelicals, has only, you know, gained in stature and following and wealth during this time. So that, to me, that tells you you've now got a money cult faith with the entire prosperity gospel, of which Osteen is the best known exponent, that's impervious to the traditional, you know, what I was describing before, where you had times where social reform gets the upper hand in the Protestant world. You know, to me, it was very striking during the whole debate over the Affordable Care Act. You didn't have any prominent, you know, mega church pastors of the Rick Warren, Joel Osteen variety weigh in at all. They didn't want to say it was bad either, because they didn't want to alienate, I guess, their more liberal-leaning followers. But to me, you know,
one would expect religious leaders to weigh in on the idea that millions of people will be able to get health care.
Yeah, exactly. And Jesus's ministry was a healing ministry. Those are the main miracles that, you know, distinguish his career. So it is a very, you know, this kind of silence we've seen, you know, since the 2008 downturn in the evangelical world, I think tells you a lot. And I think it tells you why so many of, you know, people self-described evangelicals are comfortable with a figure like Trump, who on paper, you know, he's been divorced twice, you know, is not, you know, it turns out he's lied about most of his, you know, charitable contributions, you know, by a factor of 100 or so.
Well, isn't part of it, it seems to me, that there has been a protracted project, at least, you know, in the political realm, certainly by the conservative movement, to equate wealth with morality and with righteousness, and that if it is the case that, you know, you are, you know, dollar for dollar adds to your level of sort of moral righteousness, I mean, at least, you know, according to him, he's pretty morally righteous.
Yep. As he said it at some points during the campaign, you know, I hate to say it, but in order to be great in this country, you have to be rich. Right. And, you know, I mean, Joel Osteen would say the same thing, except I don't think he would even have the disclaimer, I hate to say it.
Right, you know? And I don't think Trump really meant it either when he said, I hate to say
it. Right, yeah, it's always hard to gauge that in his case. He is sort of a carny barker.
What does the fact that if it is the case, and if you're right about the notion that after 400 years we would see the faltering of religion if it was going to happen here, is its durability tied to that? That, I mean, is there sort of that mutual, I guess, survival pact between capitalism and religion on some level that it is?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think I definitely think so. I think, you know, what the genius of American Protestantism across, you know, these four centuries has been the way it has, you know, not only, you know, thrived in what I've described as, you know, American religion is the first deregulated industry in America. when the last state established church was abolished in 1820, there was this total, land rush during the Second Great Awakening of people claiming exclusive, monopolies on religious truth. And, Mormonism in many ways is the faith that wins that contest in the 19th century. Mm. I think that what American Protestantism has done that makes it so congenial to capitalist ideology in America is it has paradoxically created a tradition of total deinstitutional reform, like this dismantling, what I was describing with the primitive church earlier, this idea that you get rid of all the accretions of history, you bore down into the pure, unmolested version of the primitive church. That, to me, is exactly, in religious terms, what libertarians are about.
Right.
It is,
decentralized.
Decentralize and deregulate get rid of, any institution is suspect. So that is why, when you had the Reagan Revolution, I think in some ways, evangelical leaders at the time allowed themselves to be seduced by political power in 1980, because, Ronald Reagan is not all that different on paper than Donald Trump. He was also divorced, indifferent churchgoer. But he importantly came out of the California post-war evangelical world. There are tons of Southern California people who became Reagan's closest advisors, who imbibed deeply of the kind of early version of the prosperity gospel.
Yes, and I think we've actually interviewed an author who's written a book about that as of late, and her name escapes me at the moment. But
probably Kim Phillips Fine.
No, I don't think it was. No. But nevertheless, I mean that tradition came out of California, where there was a sort of like a confluence between business leaders and some conservative Christian thought.
Yeah, Pentecostalists mainly. And out of that convergence comes today's prosperity gospel in large part.
I guess one of the things that occurred to me, and to bring this home a little bit, but was the part of this is tied into sort of the whole self-help movement and the line between like the prosperity gospel and self-help seems to me to be fairly blurry and moving back and forth. And I wonder, I've thought about the sort of like this new data era that we're living in, which is in many respects is very similar, it seems to me, like where there is there's a dogma and ritual and things are involved to sort of make us as efficient as possible.
right.
That seems...
Oh, that's totally true. Over at The Baffler, we critique that mercilessly. And in fact, our new issue of the magazine is largely devoted to the digital age's schemes to, control.
And that
your
seems
soul.
To me to be closely aligned in some way. And a response to harder economic times, right? Like, I've got to multitask and I've got to figure out my 4-hour work week because I want a 4-hour work week, but if I work 24 hours a day in the context of a 4-hour work week, I'm going to get six times ahead.
We are living in the kind of It's the Protestant ethic decoupled from any scheme of salvation, which is, in some ways, Weber's forecast of the dystopia where we're, the part he got wrong is that we're secularized, which is not true, but we are in this sort of iron cage of bureaucracy and we're doing crappy jobs to just, keep, the bottom line afloat.
Well,
so,
It would be nice if it led to all of our redemption, but I guess we're going to have to wait on that. And
it's true.
Chris Lehman, the book is The Money Cult, Capitalism, Christianity, and the Unmaking of the American Dream. And of course, people, we will also link to The Baffler, which is something I've been reading for years and years and enjoying it quite a bit. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Sam. It's been my pleasure. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want.